The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off with the Welcome to Oprah Insider section. Oprah on Building Your Self-Worth, and this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, everybody. Hope you had a really good holiday, some delicious hot dogs or burgers or turkey burgers or veggie burgers in the sun, celebrating with your family. This week, I want to start with a question. If you could go back in time and hand your younger self a letter, what would you tell yourself? Years ago, I wrote myself a letter just like that, addressing a 20-year-old me standing outside the television station where I had just landed my first job as a television reporter. I couldn't believe it. I was so ecstatic, excited for the future possibility and life ahead. But I was also worried about my relationship at the time, and how I was going to balance that with a guy named Bubba, my boyfriend. That's his real name. And here's what I wrote. You can see yourself only through his eyes. A lesson you will have to learn again and again and again, to see yourself with your own eyes, to love yourself from your own heart. You've spent too many days and years trying to please others and be what they wanted you to be. Well, that's a lesson I would have heeded if I could have at the time. It took me a long time to get rid of my disease to please, and reading that letter gave me chills. Because the funny thing is, I had forgotten about it until I recently recorded a podcast with Jamie Kern Lima. You might know Jamie as the founder of IT Cosmetics. She started the company in her living room while still logging long hours as a waitress, and she's gone on to be a New York Times best-selling author, sold her company for $1 billion, and now hosts the podcast, The Jamie Kern Lima Show. I know her as my across-the-fence neighbor. We literally could just trade high fives or sugar. And now she is an interviewer, and Jamie moved me to tears more than once during our conversation. She wasn't shy with her questions, and I'm hoping you'll watch or listen to the Jamie Kern Lima Show, the podcast, whenever you get a chance, wherever you get your podcasts. I've also just finished her latest book, Worthy, which is about ridding yourself of self-doubt and building unshakable self-worth. I highly recommend it if you have any feelings of being an imposter or feel like you need to know your own value. My 20-year-old self could have learned a lot from this. So have a listen and have a read if you can, and let me know in the comments, what is the one thing you would tell your younger self? And have a blessed and worthy week. Go well. We have another Welcome to Oprah Insider article. This one is Oprah on the Power of Travel, and again by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, insiders, and happy Sunday from my home to yours. I don't think it's a secret to anyone who follows me that my idea of the perfect vacation is a staycation. It's being able to sit under an oak tree with my dogs and read a really delicious book. When I do venture out, it has to be for a good reason, and exploring the world with the people I want to share the world with is one of the reasons I like to go out into the world. Some of my best memories are from vacations, like sitting and watching the sun rise over the Grand Canyon and watching a hawk soar. That time, Gail, Kirby, and I went to Umbria and did a truffle hunt with the dogs in the morning, came back with bags of truffles, and our host cooked the most incredible meal with all the truffles. Not long ago, we asked you, our Oprah Daily Insiders, a question. If you had all the time and money in the world, what would your ultimate act of self-care be? Most of your answers involved travel. Some of you, it means visiting bucket list destinations or revisiting places with personal meaning. For others, it's reuniting with friends and family, young and old, who are scattered around the country, as we all tend to be now. And that's really the reason for travel, I have to say. This week, we launched our first ever Oprah Daily Travel issue, available on Apple News, and on our site to help you plan every kind of getaway, even a last-minute 4th of July trip. I hope you all check it out. And I leave you with one more question. What would be your dream trip if you can go anywhere, with all expenses taken care of, and take anybody? Where would that be, and who would that be with? It's delicious to think about. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. Go well. This is the word of the week. Functional freeze. Is your body stuck on autopilot from stress? This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Putting off getting up to use the bathroom? Binge watching TV while scrolling for hours? Sitting on your bed in a towel for 10 minutes after showering? Apparently, these aren't just traits of distraction or procrastination. They're signs you've entered a state called functional freeze. It feels like being on autopilot, completing tasks, but doing so in a disassociative state, or while feeling empty inside, even if you look A-OK on the outside. According to Frank Anderson, M.D., a psychiatrist, trauma specialist, and author of To Be Loved, functional freeze isn't technically a nervous system response or a term rooted in science. It's more of an ongoing chronic adaptation, he explains. I would call it a protective response to functioning in the world. It's withdrawing, deconnecting or distancing yourself so you don't get hurt. The idea stems from the freeze response, which, per Anderson, is a real psychological sensation. But unlike all or nothing survival-level instincts like fight or flight, you can read about them here, functional freeze is more of a mixed mental state. You can be shut down, but also functional, Anderson explains. For instance, you might slip into functional freeze to protect yourself from rejection in a relationship. I can't be heartbroken if I'm not really feeling anything. Or because the news is so bleak. I can stomach the latest headlines if I'm getting dopamine boosts from puppy reels. Try to pay attention to when you fall into these patterns. Taking stock of what's freezing you up is the first step towards learning to thaw. So the other article referred to reading over about flight and fight, so we're going to move over to that article in Wellness, A Beginner's Guide to Trauma Responses, What Happens When We Get Triggered and How to Right-Size Our Reactions, by Jennifer King Lindley. From the outside, Allie C. Hall's childhood seemed privileged. She lived in a friendly town where her family had plenty of money for extras like nice clothes, frequent vacations, and summer camps. I was president of my third grade class. I sang in the chorus. I had lots of friends, she recalls. But this veneer masked a darker truth. I suffered years of physical and emotional abuse. To survive, Hall, today a writer in Seattle, says she lived emotionally half-frozen. I remember one moment when I was about 5 and in the middle of experiencing horrendous abuse, I did what I did so often. I found myself looking down at myself from a distance, she recalls. As she got older, Hall found new ways to flee the pain. I escaped through binge-eating sugary foods and gained a lot of weight, then progressed to bulimia. I slept with a lot of guys who were not capable of love, but then neither was I. Hall's experience of finding ways to survive an overwhelming situation is known as a trauma response. In moments of perceived danger, our mammalian body and brain automatically take over to keep us safe, if not happy. Think of a field mouse instinctively fleeing from a cat. This self-protection mode is a natural response to ensure your survival. But, as Hall's experience makes clear, these responses can get baked in and determine how you react to threats, real and perceived, for years to come. Of course, we are humans, not field mice. A trauma response may take more subtle forms of escape, like daydreaming during an important exam or zoning out during an argument with your spouse. You may not realize that you are repeating trauma response patterns. You are bringing the past into your present, carrying it around, says Victoria Renaud, PhD, a licensed clinical psychologist and director of the counseling practice Hope Plus Wellness. On TikTok, trauma response is, strange as it sounds, trending, with life coaches and influencers citing everything from oversharing to cleaning jags to Netflix binges as examples. There is a danger of overgeneralizing, says Julia Childs Heil, H-E-Y-L, a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in treating trauma. Not everyone who loves reruns of This Is Us is experiencing a trauma response. Some people may be left feeling their everyday emotions are indicative of a greater issue, which isn't always the case. We asked experts to separate the reality from the social media hype. How trauma lives in us. Traditionally, psychologists believed trauma was a consequence of only certain extreme events: war, rape, natural disasters. Today, experts believe that trauma is as much about how an event changes your brain and body as it is about the event itself. Trauma is defined as any experience that has been perceived by the individual to be dangerous or life-threatening, explains Sabrina Moreau, a clinical psychologist who specializes in treating trauma survivors. There is a disconnect between the brain and body. A nervous system has malfunctioned, and a brain has become rewired. Traumatic experiences are unique to all of us. Two individuals in the same car who experience a severe motor vehicle accident are going to develop different trauma responses. There's also a growing understanding that the slings and arrows so many of us experience in childhood, being raised by an alcoholic parent, living with the day-to-day insecurity of poverty or racism, can give rise to trauma responses that cast a long shadow into the future. If you learned in childhood that being silent protected you from more abuse, that can become a survival mechanism for life, says Moreau. Similarly, you may go through life primed for the other shoe to drop. After you experience trauma, your alarm system can get stuck where it doesn't take much to get you into a survival or a trauma response, says Patrice Berry, a clinical psychologist and founder of Four Rivers Psychological Services. Your emotional brain hijacks your thinking brain. Even minor situations can trigger one of those responses. In other words, your boss yelling at you can feel like a life or death emergency, not an issue to discuss with HR after you take a beat. The four main trauma responses. Remember, traumatic experiences are unique and individual, says Moreau. Nonetheless, many psychologists consider it helpful to think about trauma responses as falling into general categories that respond with basic survival strategies found throughout the animal kingdom: fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Here are some uniquely human ways this self-protection impulse might manifest. You might have behaviors from several categories depending on the situation or respond in your own unique ways. Fight. Using strength to fight off the threat. This can look like yelling, screaming, or cursing as a form of self-protection, says Heil. Flight. Running away from the threat. Flight can include all kinds of strategies for avoidance, sleeping too much, procrastinating, workaholism, says Barry. You might also experience what is known as disassociation and feel floaty or out of touch with what's going on around you as your brain seeks to escape the here and now, adds Heil. Freeze, playing dead to avoid being harmed. Freezing can be analysis paralysis. You feel unable to make decisions, or you can freeze physically, find yourself unable to move, says Barry. You might feel absolutely furious on the inside, but your words come out in a whisper as you sit quietly, she says. Or during an argument, you might stonewall, says Heil. That is when you completely shut down and refuse to engage. Fawn, appeasing an aggressor. You might be unable to set boundaries with others. Saying no makes you feel guilt or shame, says Barry. Or you might act clingy, says Heil. You say, oh my gosh, you're right. I'm so sorry. Do you love me? Are we okay? Am I in trouble? Paths to healing. Again, these are general categories, but it can be helpful to consider them as you reflect on your own experience. Look for patterns in your behavior when stressed, suggests Barry, as they might suggest your go-to trauma responses. Do you tend to apologize profusely at the first whiff of conflict? You might have learned fawning could keep you safe. Do you escape into work to numb your pain? That might be your flight response kicking in. Seeing your actions as trauma responses can help relieve you of long-held shame. I work with a lot of people who feel guilt over how they react in certain situations, says Barry. They don't want to be that way. They don't understand why they act in these ways. Self-awareness allows us to make different decisions. You can choose to do things that are more in line with your character and your beliefs rather than simply reacting. Understanding that trauma can become hardwired into the brain and body also suggests that a holistic mind-body approach can be effective, says Barry. If I'm arguing with my partner, taking a series of slow, calming breaths before I respond can help me re-engage my thinking brain and not do something automatically that I might regret. Seeking treatment can also be crucial. Trauma responses may have helped us stay safe. They can take time to let go of these long-held patterns, says Barry. Trauma-informed therapy approaches that work with both mind and body, includes somatic therapy, talk therapy, and EMDR. Ultimately, we want folks to not only feel safe in their body, but to feel like they have agency, Barry says. Their trauma isn't ruling their life. For her part, Hall has tapped a variety of approaches on her journey to healing. In my 20s, I joined a 12-step program, the beginning of a spiritual path for me that has been life-saving, she says. I entered therapy, and I discovered Tai Chi. The physical movements calmed my energy. It grounded me in my body again. Tai Chi cleared the way for me to come to terms with everything I had experienced. I'm no longer frozen. I am all kinds of hopeful. Any content published by Oprah Daily is for informational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. It should not be regarded as a substitute for professional guidance from your healthcare provider. Over in Lifestyle, this article is A Prayer for Budapest. The award-winning author of I Have Some Questions for You revisits her father's hometown and the capital of Hungary to find traces of their shared past. This article is by Rebecca Mackay, and that's spelled M-A-K-K-A-I. Perhaps I love Budapest because it's a stunning city with layers of Ottoman and Baroque and modern architecture, or because it's a place that makes geographical sense to me, with 8 distinctive bridges spanning the Danube, bridges I can orient myself by. Or perhaps, like a salmon, I have some kind of homing instinct that draws me to Hungary, to the place where my father grew up, where that whole side of my family lived for centuries. I can say with certainty, though, that the sound of the place is a siren song for me. My sister maintains that Hungarian makes her sleepy, reminds her of falling asleep to the sound of relatives talking. For me, it's both comforting and invigorating, like a song you can't help singing along to, with the slight complication that I don't actually know the song. The thing is, I have two native languages, but I speak only one. I'm not alone in this. Perhaps you're like me, immersed from birth in the sounds and rhythms of a language that was never spoken to you, one you never learned to speak. Perhaps like me, when you travel later in life to the place where that language is spoken by everyone, you find something long dormant springing to life in your core. In the crowded downtown streets, you'll hear a lot of English and German, but up in the Buda Hills, where my father lived out the end of his life, or on the basement level of the Great Market Hall, the level that smells like fish and pickles, or in the literary cafes frequented by generations of Hungarian writers, or in and out of the way restaurants serving tourists unfriendly foods like tripe stew or sour lungs or sweet noodles, you'll hear only the most beautiful, rolling, harmonious language on the planet. I grew up near Chicago, speaking English, but surrounded at home by Hungarian. My father, a refugee after the failed 1956 Hungarian Revolution, spoke Hungarian on the phone, and with the Hungarian cousins and friends who filled our house, and later with my stepmother. No one spoke the language directly to me or my sister, which meant that while the cadences and music of the language went deep in our bones, we never learned to speak it. We knew words for food, of course, and how to count. There were songs and rhymes. My favorite was the ancient one that mocked a rotund Turkish pasha. And every night, with either my father or my mother, we had learned Hungarian, there was a bedtime prayer. It would be familiar to most Hungarian children. It starts, "En estinam ju estinam lukukudik mar semen," and means, in its entirety, "My God, my good God, already my eyes are closing. But yours are open, Father, while I sleep, watch over me. Watch over my dear parents and my siblings. When the sun rises again, let us kiss each other in the morning." In Hungarian, it rhymes and has a lilting rhythm. Although my father would occasionally remind me of the meanings of songs or rhymes, this one is about spring flowers, this is about trotting soldiers. Mostly, it all came to me as a mob of sounds. I knew every syllable, but I had no idea where one word stopped and the next word started. Over time, the lullabies and nursery rhymes and prayers fell by the wayside. I don't have much cause to mock Turkish pashas these days. As an agnostic, I haven't raised my own children with memorized bedtime prayers. After my father moved back to Hungary in 2014, though, I began returning to Budapest regularly. On my first trip to see him, my first visit there in many years, I was exploring the Christmas market in Vörösmarty Square with my sister and drinking hot wine from a street cart when I was struck by a word on a restaurant sign. Regeli, which, next to photos of ham and eggs, clearly meant breakfast. This word surely wasn't from a childhood prayer or song, so why could I hear it so clearly in my father's voice? The soft emphasis on the first syllable, the stickiness of the double G, and then I had it. It was the root word, regel, that I recognized. The ending of the prayer, it means morning. Zolak hasak egsh masht regel. Let us kiss each other in the morning. And in case I didn't pronounce that correctly, it is C-S-O with an accent mark over the O, K-O-L-H-A-S-S-U-K. The second word is E-G-Y-M-A with an accent mark over the A, S-T. And the last word is REGGEL. I had made many short-lived attempts over the years to learn Hungarian properly, but always gave up, overwhelmed. Hungarian is, by all accounts, one of the very hardest languages for an English speaker to learn. Not Romance or Slavic or even Indo-European. It's related to not much but Finnish, and only barely. There are conservatively counting 18 noun cases. The four tiers of grammatical politeness complicate already baffling verb conjugations. There aren't just different rules, there are different types of rules. The intricate system of vowel harmony makes the language beautiful but infinitely more difficult. It's no coincidence that the Rubik's Cube was invented in Hungary. To complete even a simple present tense sentence, you need to calculate in multiple directions. On a subsequent visit, this time with my older daughter, I was walking in the residential streets of the Buda Hills, past houses with red-tiled roofs, and backyard vineyards and barking dogs. A hand-painted sign on one gate showed a dog in silhouette beside the word Vigas. There it was again on a similar sign. The word rang a bell deep in my body. After a minute, I had it, and this word, too, was from my childhood prayer. Vigas rim. I confirmed on my phone means take care of me. These signs wanted us to take care, to watch out for dogs who were probably not all that fierce. My old childhood prayer, it seemed, was following me around the city, slowly revealing itself to me. As an adult, I became resentful that my sister and I had not been raised bilingual. How much easier that would have been. Hungarians love to joke that Hungarian isn't hard at all. I myself learned it when I was only two. But in the Iron Curtain era, my father never anticipated that we'd spend time there, or have use for a language spoken only in a region the size of Indiana. I understand why he didn't feel it was worth the trouble, but still, when I'm in Budapest and I see a young child speaking it fluently, or a drunk slurring it from a bench, I think, why can't I have that? I want to be only as fluent as that toddler, as intelligible as that wino. On those first few visits to Budapest, it was easy, and it is in most cities, to learn the words for open and closed, Nyitva and Zarva, but the former was, once again, deeply familiar. As I stood outside the open bakery, not going inside, the other customers probably believed I was staring at the poppy seed, Begli and creams in the window. In fact, I was repeating the word to myself until I'd placed it in my memory. Dia tied nitva, but yours are open. The same word for the eyes of God and the operating hours of a tobacco shop or a dry cleaner. My father passed away in January 2020, and my plans to come to Hungary for the memorial service that spring were dashed by the pandemic. During lockdown, I started learning Spanish with my younger daughter on Duolingo. Why on earth couldn't Hungarian be this easy? In just a couple of months, I was able to have the kind of rudimentary conversation in Spanish that I couldn't manage even after 40 years of desultory Hungarian study. And perhaps Hungarian, after all, wasn't even worth it. I wasn't going to live my life there. My father was gone. And since so few foreigners learn Hungarian, native speakers struggle to understand anyone with an accent. It was over 2 years before I could return to sort through my father's things, to visit his grave. He was buried in the new public cemetery founded in 1886. It's still new, I suppose, by European standards. One of the largest cemeteries on the continent, it contains over 3 million graves, most of them covered in candles and flowers. It's crowded with the living, as well, people kneeling in prayer, clipping weeds, selling floral wreaths. On many tombstones and plaques around the cemetery, I saw the word Istin. This one I placed right away in the prayer and knew without Googling what it was. This was the word for God. But on others, I recognized another word. ATM, which I had to look up. It's a formal word of saying my father, more like my heavenly father than like dad. ATM, Easton. This was whom I'd been praying to all those years, without even knowing which words were which. I found this wildly comforting, as if my childhood prayer had suddenly been answered. You might be thinking now that this is a story about religious awakening, that I realized God was following me around Budapest, watching over me. If that's your hope, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I remain agnostic. This is, instead, a story about deciding to run full throttle at the challenge of a language I'll never speak well that I can't let go of. There are people who can't let go of their parents' religion, despite no longer believing in it. Not really. There are those who can never shake their hometown accents, or their youthful fears, or their love of a food that reminds them of childhood summers in a small, sad town. Because to cling to those things is to cling to the very foundations of who you are. Every trace of my childhood Hungarian that I find sprinkled around Budapest allows me another slight grasp of vocabulary and grammar, another reassurance that this language does belong to me, however awkwardly. I'm at the point now where I can express some half-coherent ideas. As it turns out, I can understand a lot more than I can say, and often I can't explain why I can understand. It's less like learning a language than like slowly, slowly recognizing it. This is the map those words were making me throughout the city, the message those clues were spelling. You can understand a language you don't speak. You can take comfort in a religion that's not yours. If you let yourself, and if you let yourself try, you can remember things you never knew. In the lifestyle section, 11 summer travel hacks that will save you money. Our resident travel expert shows you how to game the system on flights and hotels. If you are planning a summer trip this year, and even if you are late to the game, there's good news all around. Domestic airfares are down, according to the travel firm Hopper, at 5% cheaper than summer 2023. And hotel room rates in the U.S. are softer by roughly the same margin. An increase in international airline capacity flights to Europe from the U.S. alone have seen an 8% uptick this summer versus last year, has helped ease pressure on prices, translating to 10% savings. Still, if you find yourself balking at rates, you aren't imagining things. Traveling after the pandemic is, in fact, pricier than it was before COVID shutdowns. Airfares are 10% higher overall than they were in 2019, and the average cost of a room domestically last year at $180 was around $15 higher than it was 4 years earlier. The following is our travel savings playbook for this summer and beyond. How to score the best deals on hotels. Number one, bar none. It's a mistake to assume that endless Googling will unearth cheaper prices than simply booking directly on a hotel's website. These days, such direct bookings will almost always offer what's known as the bar, or B-A-R, or best available rate. The reason is simple. By booking directly with the hotel on its own site, the property won't need to share commission with hotels.com and the like, so it can pass on the savings to you. You'll also avoid the scammy vendors that often clutter the results of such resellers, offering seemingly cheaper deals that turn out to be more expensive when you finally reach the payment page. Number two, find the freebies. If you're planning to stay with a chain like Accor, A-C-C-O-R, or Marriott, make sure to join its loyalty program, which is always free. In exchange for your data, you'll get bonus benefits like comped breakfast or gratis Wi-Fi. Number three, if you don't ask, you won't get. Don't be afraid to engage with the hotel directly to ask if there's flexibility around a given rate. Send a polite email pointing out that you'd love to book 5 nights but wondered if there's an incentive they could offer for that longer stay. a 10% discount, perhaps, or a free meal or two. We promise it's not tacky. They are thrilled to offer something to you in exchange for booking directly with them. See number one. Number four, future-proof your price for free. Do you have the niggling fear that after you've settled on a price, it will go down? That's where Pruvo comes in. Make sure to book a refundable room. Then forward the confirmation to save@pruvo.com. Pruvo is spelled P-R-U-V-O. You can also install a Google Chrome extension, which automates the process even further. The company's software will then monitor for price cuts and alert you when they happen, prompting you to cancel that first reservation and snap up the same room at a lower rate. Pruvo is free to use, too, as it makes money through commissions, and per the firm's own studies, prices drop in 4 out of 10 cases after booking, on average by around 14%. Number 5. Resale isn't limited to vintage clothes. If you're heading to a popular destination, consider a reseller like Rumor. Think of this like eBay for hotel rooms. Anyone with a non-refundable booking they can no longer use can list it for resale via Rumor. Free to list, and sellers pay a 15% fee when it sells. You can then snap up that room at a discounted rate, so the original traveler loses less money than they might have done otherwise, and you score a superb deal on a room that isn't otherwise discounted. A win-win. Rumor claims that the average discount is around 45%, but expect it to be lower in peak season in prime places. Travel like it's 2010. This is number 6. Remember Groupon, that deal offering darling of a decade ago? It's still operating, albeit at a lower profile, and you can often score great packages there. The best way to use it is to search its getaways collections and sort by category, whether casino hotels or water parks, and then by price. How to score the best deals on flights. Number 1. New routes equals smart deals. One of the best strategies for saving is to focus on what's new, whether routes, airlines, or destinations. Lesser-known routes are by definition cheaper and are more likely to use promotions to gin up interest. Take the West Coast Caribbean routing, a formerly less popular route where airlines are now seeing interest in adding service with gusto. Several carriers have introduced new non-stops. Cayman Airways, for example, expanded its LAX Grand Cayman service to twice weekly late last year, while JetBlue programmed on LAX Nassau flight around the same time, connecting Southern California with the Bahamas non-stop. Alaska Airlines did the same thing with year-round service from LA to Guatemala. It also now offers a winter getaway from Seattle and LA to Nassau, the first ever direct to the Bahamas from CEA. Number 2. Go beyond the big names. Don't forget that there's a range of airlines beyond the major carriers. Many of them startups with smarter business models. Translation, better fares for you. Use Google Flights for the broadest search, and when you see the results, pull down the Airlines tab. Scan it for unfamiliar names beyond Delta, American, and Southwest. Consider Breeze Airways, for example, which calls itself the nice, low-cost carrier, with benefits like brand spanking new planes and bargain prices. Most of the planes are already fitted with Wi-Fi for in-flight entertainment to stream to your device, and every plane will be by fall. It was started 3 years ago by David Neeleman, the same man who invented JetBlue more than 2 decades ago. Its main area of focus is the Southeast rather than the Northeast, where JetBlue started. It has hubs in Charleston, Tampa, Norfolk, and New Orleans. The most recently added Breeze hub was Fort Myers, Florida. Neeleman's new carrier connects smaller airports, often in cities that were once well served by those major carriers before they consolidated and cut back. Number 3, and go ever more niche regional carrier. Don't discount super niche regional carriers like Silver Airways, a South Florida headquartered operator that serves the Caribbean, just because you have never heard of them. There are one-way flights from West Palm Beach to the Bahamas, for example, starting at $59 one way. Bermuda Air is another notable startup. It connects the island territory, still deeply British despite its proximity to the U.S., with five cities here, including Baltimore and Orlando. Number four, new airports unlock destinations. Tulum is one of the hottest destinations in Mexico. The Instagram-anointed wellness hub that's now rivaling Cancun and Cabo San Lucas in popularity. The biggest issue for quick trips there wasn't logistical. It's an hour-plus drive from Cancun Airport, the region's longtime hub. With traffic, it could take much longer. The problem was resolved earlier this year with the opening of TQO, Tulum's own international airport, which quickly saw service added for almost every major U.S.-based carrier. Delta, United, American, and JetBlue are already operating service there. Number five, warehouse clubs are the best-kept travel secret. If you have a membership to a warehouse club, such as Sam's or Costco, there are travel deals available to you already that you've probably never noticed. Go to the website and look for a travel tab. Costco, for example, offers packages, hotels, cruises, and rental cars, which include member-only discounts on all those categories. Similarly, there's a tab on airlines' websites that many people overlook, like the vacations tab on AA.com and Southwest.com, among others. These also offer packages, a popular way to travel in Europe, where flights and hotel rooms are bundled. Although we Americans are less inclined to book this way, these deals can be especially meaningful during peak season. Here's how it works. Airlines allocate seats on certain flights to these packages and ring-fence them from the algorithms that typically control prices, which makes them markedly less susceptible to spikes in pricing of any kind. If you're traveling in peak season, whether July or Thanksgiving, this means that such bundled deals can sometimes prove cheaper than booking the flight alone. Another article in Lifestyle. Attention, parents of littles. Traveling with adult children might just be the greatest gift of the second half of life. Somewhere between the tantrum years when you'll need a vacation from your vacation and grandchildren is a golden era of family travel. This article is by Lucy Kalin. When did the word vacation become so fraught? When did the lovely notion of a break from the grind become such a grind? The concept is solid. A set time to disconnect from our stressors, safeguarded by things like out-of-office bounce-backs that deliver a firm message. Not now. I'm on me time. If you're vacationing with family, however, me time becomes we time, although rarely we time, more like wah time. If the kids are little, melting down at regular intervals from exhaustion or frustration over the fun activities you've thoughtfully lined up, the agricultural museum, the dead author house tour, the whale-free whale watch, their tear-stained longing to be reunited with their screens grows operatic. But over time, things change, I'm happy to report. When the kids are grown, as mine are, in their 20s and not yet saddled with children of their own, most travel hassles simply fall away. By now they have matured and are fully socialized, no longer pitching fits when faced with yet another steep flight of stone steps up to yet another musty, must-see cultural institution. They carry their own bags, helping with the planning, and happily pick up the occasional tab. I nearly fell over the first time that happened. Simply put, they are a pleasure to travel with. And yet, new complications arise. For starters, our children live across the country, making our time with them inordinately, achingly precious. No pressure there. Furthermore, they have robust social lives and full-time jobs. It's a legit miracle when all our dates line up. And then there's the great next turn of the wheel looming up ahead. When they have families of their own, with all that implies, and diminished parents, less able to sightsee or handle a long flight. Now our times together thrum with the bittersweet sense of knowing we won't always be able to do this. Consider our most recent effort to achieve family nirvana, which offered a hint of what is to come. In recent years, some leisurely, far-flung excursion was a given. They had the time, and we all had the will. Now, though, our daughter and her boyfriend were up to their eyeballs in friends' weddings, making a two-weeker with us a non-starter. So we pivoted, planning an extra-long weekend instead. Convenient to them and our son in Southern California, we'd take what we could get. Where, though, would be special and versatile enough to serve us all over such a short period of time? The guys in our gang of five are golfers. So that emerged as an organizing principle. As for my daughter and me, both hardworking, anxiety-prone professionals, we defaulted to self-care. Rancho Valencia was suggested, a resort in Rancho Santa Fe, California. Crucially, it was a mere 20-minute drive to Torrey Pines Golf Course and had a highly regarded spa, two for two. Mindfully laid out over 45 acres with Technicolor hot air balloons suspended in the sky, the place exuded a palpable ease, starting with the staff. From the woman who welcomed us at the security gate, to the concierge, to the guy who showed us to our own private casitas, we were handled with a light touch. None of the abject bending and scraping that some posh places seem to pride themselves on, making me feel like a bad person, an impostor, or both. Here the amenities are more gracious than showy. Glasses of fresh-squeezed orange juice awaited us each morning on a little ledge outside our front porch. The free-of-charge minibar. No, it wasn't stocked with splits of champagne or artisanal chocolates, just juices and snacks. Still, the tone-setting decision to eschew minibar gouging struck me as the height of class. To be clear, some of the amenities at Rancho Valencia are pretty darn showy, like the Bentleys and Porsches parked outside reception that guests can take for a spin, although even those were preferred in a light-hearted, isn't this a gas kind of way. After the guys tromped off with their golf bags, provided by the hotel, another nice touch, my daughter and I hit the spa. If I'd had any concern about the trip being too much about golf, it quickly vanished in this tranquil, unfussy, me-time haven. Wearing lush robes and slides, holding cups of tea in both hands, we made our way, monk-like, to the hushed rooms where we received the best facials of our lives. I have to believe the layered portions and rapid fingerwork of my natural lift treatment sped up collagen synthesis, as the spa menu'd promised. The experience left us feeling emotionally exfoliated. On chaises afterwards, eyes closed side by side, my daughter and I indulged in some deliciously deep and open conversation, unimaginable during the fractious teen years, utterly the norm for us now. Another day we all did the sauna-slash-steam-slash-cold-plunge circuit, goosing our heart rates from setting up camp at the secluded spa pool, not to be confused with a second pool used by families with little kids. I love little kids, but boy, was it nice to be spared their shrieks and detritus. Their food-flinging lunch. Been there, did a lot of that. At night, we had dinner by candlelight amid the olive and citrus groves on the terrace at the hotel. We ate steak and sea bass, squash blossom quesadillas, and lobster tacos, artichokes and Brussels sprouts grown there at the ranch. Our table was a blur of revolving small plates as we each endeavored to taste everything. Between practically every bite, we raised our glasses to toast our good luck at having this time together. It goes fast, 4 days. We packed in what we could. There was open-air yoga, cornhole, and pickleball, my first time. There was a visit to the vegetable garden, the herb garden, the flower garden, and a large coop housing the chickens that had supplied the eggs for our breakfast burritos and omelets. Many thanks. There was an afternoon in nearby La Jolla where we visited the aquarium, perused a funky bookstore, and ate lunch at a literal fish market serving insanely fresh sashimi. And there was a tour. My husband's of the humble homes he'd crashed in, the Mexican restaurants he'd worked in, and the surf breaks he'd mastered when he lived there decades ago during college. It moved us, the full circleness of it all. One of my favorite moments came late at night, at the mosaic tile fire pit at Rancho Valencia. It was postprandial drinks. More toasts. Cracking heat in the cool canyon air and war stories from the Lynx. Yes, I guess we'll get old someday, but times like this, wherever we are, never will. In Lifestyle, Jamie Kern Lima on Building Self-Worth and her Dream First podcast guest. As Oprah said, we do not become what we want, we become what we believe we're worthy of. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Jamie Kern Lima's career has been defined by her dedication to real and inclusive beauty standards, starting with how she revolutionized the industry by founding IT Cosmetics, a line of problem-solving products that were created with insights from plastic surgeons and dermatologists. The entrepreneur and philanthropist is taking this a step further as the host of a new podcast, The Jamie Kern Lima Show, where none other than Oprah was her first guest. Part 1 of her conversation with Oprah debuted last week, and Part 2 premieres today on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Kern Lima sat down with Oprah Daily to discuss how she scored her dream come true first guest, how Oprah's wisdom has influenced her throughout her life, and what she learned in diving deep into building self-worth. How do self-worth issues show up in someone's life? Low self-worth sabotages us as every chance it gets. In fact, the real reason we often feel so stuck on the inside is because deep down, we don't believe we're worthy. Worthy of our wants, needs, or going for our personal goals. Now, if you have low to medium self-worth, you might end up going for your dreams, but then you sabotage yourself along the way. This also applies to our relationships. Our self-worth becomes our ceiling for what we're willing to accept from other people. What should you do if you're struggling with self-worth? First of all, you're not alone. 80% of women don't believe they're enough, and 73% of men feel inadequate. But it's never too late, and never too early, to start building self-worth. Building self-worth is not something where you have to learn a lot of things, but rather a journey of unlearning the lies that led to self-doubt and igniting those truths that wake up worthiness. For some, it's both a daily and a lifelong journey of building worthiness inside. The main thing to take away is that there are bigger dreams out there for all of us. Bigger than what we can possibly imagine for ourselves. Our job is learning to believe that we're worthy of that dream. It's the only way to step into it. There's a book that also goes along with this article, if you're interested. The book is called Worthy by Jamie Kern Lima, How to Believe You Are Enough and Transform Your Life. Simple Steps, Life-Changing Results. The book is $18 at Amazon if you're interested in buying it. Over in Culture and News, Tina Knowles reveals what Blue Ivy Carter is like at 12. Beyonce's daughter is never attention-seeking, but sings beautifully, paints, dances, and more. This article is by Alyssa Bailey. After Beyoncé's 12-year-old daughter, Blue Ivy Carter, won her second BET award, Tina Knowles shared a proud grandma Instagram tribute. Her post gave rare, extensive detail about Blue and just what the preteen is like as the family celebrates Blue's BET Young Stars win. As Knowles put it, Blue is a bit of a musical prodigy. voice like an angel, her grandma shared, yet very humble, kind, and down to earth. Never attention-seeking, just cool and chill as a cucumber all the time, Knowles wrote. Yesterday you played the piano for just me, like someone who has been taking lessons for years. But you are self-taught. One day, I hope you will let me post it and brag like other grandmas get to do. But for now, you made me swear to not share. Knowles shared so much more about Blue's artistic talent. Read her full caption below. Congratulations, my Blue Blue. I marvel at your talent, your beauty, your intelligence. But I am most proud of your kindness and down-to-earth attitude. Never attention-seeking, just cool and chill as a cucumber all the time. Yesterday you played the piano for just me, like someone who's been taking lessons for years, but you are self-taught. One day I hope you will let me post it and brag like other grandmothers get to do, but for now you made me swear to not share. You play sports, play the piano, dance like a pro in front of 80,000 people, paint like a fine artist, draw so well, sing so beautifully, voice like an angel. Voiced an award-winning best-selling children's book. You are also in a soon-to-come blockbuster movie, Lion King, one of the youngest recipients of a Grammy Award. And you turned only 12 years old a few months ago. And in spite of all the challenged adults who struggle with a green-eyed monster disease, and true Carter/Knowles/Beyoncé tradition, it just motivates you to keep it moving. Congratulations, BIC. You deserve everything you work hard to get. Thank you, BET. #BetaAwards for this honor. We have a book recommendation now, Happiness Falls by Angie Kim. Everything seemed normal the morning of Mia's father's disappearance, but an abnormality in 0.00000003% of her younger brother's DNA resulted in a condition that leaves him the only one who knows what happened on that fateful morning, perpetually smiling and unable to speak. As the mystery of her father's disappearance becomes entangled with mysteries of the human condition, the question arises, can we ever really know those we love? This book, Happiness Falls by Angie Kim, is available for $15 at Amazon and $17 at Bookshop. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.